Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The court. My name is Tom Goldstein, and I represent Qualcomm. I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal and be attentive to my time, of course.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors. In the time since the district court decided this case, a number of things have happened. A motions panel.
I'm sorry. It's 25 minutes.
Thank you for looking out for me.
and you're giving 5 minutes to the...
I have 20, and then the Department of Justice has 5, Your
That's
Honor.
Why it's... I'm yes. sorry. That's why it was 20. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So a motions panel of this court, of course, stayed the district court's ruling with an order indicating that in that preliminary review, it seemed that the ruling was either at or outside the boundaries of settled antitrust law. The Department of Justice has filed a brief saying very much outside, and that the ruling presents a direct threat to national security. The FTC then filed its brief, which abandons law.
The FTC then?
Yeah, after the Department of Justice, the FTC. We have the government.
Oh, I heard you say SEC.
Sorry, SEC. No. We have an alphabet soup of agencies, but they are not among them. So the FTC has filed a brief that kind of disclaims significant parts of the district court's ruling and tries to defend what's left. And what's left, I think I'd like to focus on the surcharging ruling. This is the idea that Qualcomm takes its supposed monopoly power in two chip markets and uses that to get very high patent royalty rates, and
So what you're saying, because of the FTC's concessions, is that what? My understanding is the FTC conceded that the district court was wrong on the duty to deal part and the reliance on Aspen, saying that, and then they make a fallback argument that has to do with the contractual arguments on the FRAND.
Correct.
Am I correct on that?
Yes.
So I'm not really sure exactly. You were talking about subsequent developments. So I guess if I was going to eventually, I mean, it doesn't make the case go away.
Oh, no. Here we are.
Okay.
Yeah, very much so.
So if based on that concession by the FTC, my question is, what does that do? Is if you pull that strand out of the, and I guess if we accept the concession that everyone says that the Aspen scheme is very narrow, that that doesn't answer the question, the district court was wrong on the duty to deal part of it, what does that do to the rest of the district court's analysis?
Sure. Well, you would need to confront the FTC's alternative argument for affirmance. If you were to reject that and conclude that there is no duty to deal under either the district court's theory or the FTC's alternative theory, you would have the decision to make. As the Department of Justice says, we agree that it would at the very least require vacating the judgment. The district court itself said that we're essentially three legs to the stool of the antitrust violation here, and one of those would be gone. You could leave it to the district court in that instance to decide whether to reinstitute the judgment. We would not do that because the district court has a very extensive discussion of the surcharging ruling. The FTC regards it as the essence of the case, and I am concerned that it would be quite inefficient and we would be back relatively soon. The case is fully briefed on the other grounds that the district court rested its decision on. So it would be within your discretion to simply say, well, let's see what the district court has to say from here. But we do think the sounder approach
would
be... All
right, so we have the injunction.
Yes.
All right, and then we also have the summary judgment,
which
my understanding is it was not cross motion for summary judgment. You lost on the summary judgment, so your position is that there are tribal issues and that the injunction should be vacated.
That's right.
And
so that is the, and just to put that kind of in the context of your earlier question, their alternative grounds for affirmance is premised on the correctness of the summary judgment ruling. If you were to agree with us that there were disputed issues of material fact, that would resolve their alternative ground for affirmance itself. So you wouldn't get to the question of whether the contractual obligation under FRAND gives rise to a duty to deal.
So, counsel, in your view, are we still reviewing a finding regarding Section 1 and Section 2 of the Antitrust Act? What's your view on that?
This is purely going to be a unilateral monopoly maintenance case under Section 2. And there were three theories of the district court on why it is that we had violated the Section 2, and they were in combination, according to the district court. The one that the FTC has focused on the most is the surcharging ruling. There is the exclusive dealing discounting part of the case as well, and they have walked away from Judge Koh's very broad ruling about all of our discounting arrangements, and so there's an argument about these specific expired Apple agreements. But if I think what would be most useful, although we'll talk about, of course, whatever the court wants to, is to talk about this surcharging ruling. It's mm-hmm. the idea that we have monopoly power with respect to chips. That gets us very high royalty rates on our intellectual property. And then what happens is a bit of a mystery, to be honest. The FTC has argued...
Well, do you disagree about the assumption that you have monopoly power as to chips?
We do not.
Okay.
In this court, we have accepted that ruling. We're trying to be very careful and conscious of the clearly erroneous standard as it comes to factual findings. We're very focused with respect to the surcharging ruling. There are three separate legal errors.
But I mean, everything you said before you got to the murkiness is true. We all agree on this, right? You have monopoly power. Right.
We do not agree that we charge excessive royalty rates. We do contest that. There is a body of law that comes from the Federal Circuit.
Well, even if you did, would that constitute?
No. Right. That is correct. So we have three lines of argument. Even if one accepts the
Even if you did, would that constitute anti-competitive, monopolistic, Sherman Act violative conduct?
It would not. So the court has put its finger on, I think, the central issue in the case. And that is from decisions like Brantley and a long line of authority, where is the harm to the competitive process? Even if one assumes that the district court had it right to the point that we were somehow injuring our competitors, what has gone wrong in the competitive process? And the answer to that question is nothing, and that there isn't an antitrust violation here. There might be a contractual violation or something else.
Right.
Counsel.
Maybe even a patent violation.
Sure. Absolutely. There are bodies of law that deal with this problem. The antitrust laws just aren't them.
Counsel, do you take issue with the notion that the royalties constitute surcharges?
We do, Your Honor, in two different respects. The first I mentioned, and that is, are they excessive in the first place? The settled body of law is that you look to whether there's an established royalty rate, and it is uncontested that outside the monopolized markets, or even inside the monopolized markets where we don't sell chips, we get the same royalty rate. But even if one accepts that the royalty rate is somehow too high, the question is this case like Caldera? So in the whole history of antitrust law, the FTC has fallen back to a 1999 decision from the District of Utah that dealt with a very different situation.
There, so did the district court say that about the intrinsic value? Was that of the is am I on a different point here? But it seemed that the district court said that the royalty rates were they had to be tied to the intrinsic value.
That's right. So there is.
And is there any case that says that?
No, Your Honor. So there is a subsidiary dispute in the case about whether it is we should be basing the royalty rate on the value of the handset, for example, or instead of the chip. Our point is that the royalties relate to the entire phone because we have technology that's in our patent portfolio about displays and user interfaces and GPS technology. It's perfectly appropriate that we require that a royalty be based on the entire handset, which includes all of that.
So complete this sentence. The royalty is not a surcharge because
there are two reasons. The first is it's not excessive, and the second is it does not affect the decision of the handset maker of which chip to buy. So in Caldera, you have a situation where Microsoft said to computer manufacturers, here is our deal. You are going to pay a license, and that license fee is going to include Microsoft's product, no matter whether you use our product or you don't use our product. That was for the monopolized product. So there, if you were a computer manufacturer, you said, gosh, do I want to pay for a competing operating system? Because then I'll have to pay for the competing operating system and also the Microsoft operating system. This case is entirely different. And importantly, not even the district court thought that the rationale of Caldera applied here. The district court just thought that Caldera was loosely analogous because here's what happens in our case. We do have a license, as we're supposed to, with the cell phone makers because they use our technology. That's not a problem. But when you are a cell phone handset maker and you take our license, then you have to buy a chip. And that license fee doesn't tell you anything about why you should buy our chip versus somebody else's chip. You decide on the basis of the chip. So,
well, let me ask you about, would you concede if your policy was, your policy is no license, no chip?
That is how the FTC is characterized.
Okay, but what if it was no chip, no license? Would that be anti-competitive?
If we, and just to put it in terms, if
I'm
we set,
saying hypothetically.
Right, and
you're
I just
saying
want,
it's because I, we have all the license. Because I'm not sure whether, because you'd be making a must-have item, and then your, do you say SEP or SEP licenses?
As you will, both.
Huh?
We use both.
Okay. Would be contingent on OEMs buying your modem chips instead of competitors' modem chips. So what? So do you have a no license, no chip, or a no chip, no license? And it seemed that the district court may have conflated those. So
It may well.
So what's anti-competitive and what's not?
Well, if we required, if you have to actually look into the facts. Here's the, I think, the really important thing, and that is you can't assume anything here. What the court's decisions require is you have to have a theory of anti-competitive harm and then proof that it actually happens here. So the theory of anti-competitive harm here for the district court was that somehow our patent royalty rates caused our competitors to sell fewer products. And this court has made very clear that if you have a, every time somebody competes with somebody else, they want the competitor to make less money. And if I get the business, they're not going to get the business. What the court's cases are concerned with is what happens to the competitive process. And cases like Brantley and all of the bundling cases say, you have an antitrust problem when you get to the point that you are engaging in predatory pricing. Now, the measure of pricing, predatory pricing, might vary somewhat, but we know that it isn't met here because the district court affirmatively found that we engage in monopolistic chip pricing. So there is no reduction of our price to the point where an equally efficient competitor would not be able to sell and take the business away from us.
You don't have any competitors.
Oh, we do have competitors, Your Honor. In fact...
Well, not who can compete... Not who you can predatorily price against.
Right. And so there is no evidence. The FTC disclaimed the ability to prove that we reduce our prices in a way so that there is somebody who is equally efficient who would not be able to take the business away from us.
I have to interrupt. Aspen skiing is not relevant anymore. Everybody concedes that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I will say, just as one data point, below the FTC's theory of duty to deal, even right. when it came to the FRAND obligation,
right.
was that Aspen skiing controls. They've reversed themselves in this court.
Right. Okay. Calderon is loosely analogous, but not controlling.
Well, it wouldn't be controlling in any event because it's a District of Utah decision. But yes, not even the district court thought it was controlling.
Right. In its 70-page analysis of Qualcomm's, as my colleague said, no license, no chips conduct, the court didn't cite any cases for why. I'm trying to figure out where we go legally to determine what's competitive and what's not, or at least to apply a definition or a guidance of a court in terms of competitive monopolistic behavior of Qualcomm against what the Sherman Act prohibits.
Yes, Your Honor. We agree with the Department of Justice that while the district court does have 70 pages objecting to how we treat our customers, that results, if anything, in higher customer prices, which ought to get the competitors in the door. But
right.
there's only 3 pages about what you're asking about. What's the theory of competitive harm?
Right.
And we don't think there are any analogous cases. And I will say...
Is there a conflating of profitable and anti-competitive?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And that is, the district court thought that when we engage in practices, that licensing practices, that make our competitors less profitable, and that is, it's a doctrine called raising rivals' costs, that somehow, you know, because when they sell chips, the phone still involves our patent licenses, that was itself, when our rivals' profits go down, a competition problem. And that is not correct. It has to reach a certain point, and that is the competitive process itself has to be harmed. And the district...
Well, so if... I guess, and I want to hear from the other side in this, but if no license, no chips helped Qualcomm make lots of money for a few years, is that in and of itself an antitrust violation, even if consumers paid higher prices for cell phones?
No, and in fact, it is an antitrust good. The Supreme Court makes very clear in the Trinco case that it is the prospect that a monopolist will make a lot of money that encourages us to engage in a lot of innovation. We have invested $60 billion in what is an extremely vibrant industry in developing new technology on the prospect that we will be able to collect high intellectual property royalties and high chip prices. That is what capitalism is intended to encourage.
Well, the district court and the FTC repeatedly faulted Qualcomm's practice as being unique in the industry and a departure from the way business was done previously. Does that equate to anti-competitive, or is that just being a disruptor? That's what I want to ask the other side on that, but it seems that that discussion was fairly central.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. I do think that there is a conflation. The district court was kind of suspicious of how we do business. Now, the premise is wrong. All of the major cellular SEP owners do what we do, and that is license at the OEM level and not to their chip rival. So it's very similar in that way. The reason we're different is because we have a very different business. We do have 140,000 patents and patent applications. And then we have an industry-leading chip sector. There just isn't somebody else that you can make an apples-to-apples comparison. The question you're asked is there a harm to the competitive process? Are we charging too low prices so that our chip rivals can't get in there? But the district court, and this is why the clearly erroneous standard is our friend, not our enemy, affirmatively found repeatedly that our chip prices are monopolistically high. Mm-hmm. If that's true, I just don't understand the theory for why it is we're blocking competition in the industry.
Well, wasn't there multiple competitors entered the modem chip market successfully beginning around 2015, leading to a precipitous decline in Qualcomm's market share since then?
Yes, so, that's absolutely right.
So do you have to decide, okay, you have this unique structure, but does it have to destroy competition itself in order to be a violation, or what?
I mean, to say destroy competition is probably an overstatement, so I don't mean to set too high a bar that's unfair to the government in an antitrust case, but we have to injure the competitive process. You have to believe that what we are doing is, in the long, here's the idea. The idea is that if we put our prices too low, we'll drive everybody else out of the business, and then we'll raise our prices back up again, and that will be bad for consumers in the end. That is not this case. The district court did not purport to find anything like that. If I could reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Michael Murray for the United States.
Good morning.
Morning. The novel
Which agency? I mean, are you from the Department of Justice?
Department of Justice, yes.
Right. We have two parts of the government here today.
Yes, so that's true, Your Honor.
Really interesting.
Are you in the antitrust division?
I am, Your Honor. The novel district court decision should be vacated for two reasons. First, the district court's global, expansive remedy was entered without proper consideration of the public interest, including national security concerns. And second, the district court's ruling deserves competition and innovation by imposing a duty to deal where there is none and by misequating high prices with harm to competition.
Counsel, may I ask you what case authority you're relying upon for the proposition that in determining antitrust matters that national security has a factor? Is there a case that supports that proposition, or is this a policy argument that you're making?
I think it's undisputed at this point, Your Honor, that E.I. DuPont, which states that an antitrust remedy should be entered with, quote, as little injury as possible to the interest of the general public, is applicable to this case.
So is your argument directed solely toward the injunction?
This part of the argument is, Your Honor. And I think the other case that is particularly instructive is the Supreme Court's decision in Winter v. NRDC. all we're asking for, despite some overheated rhetoric in this case from various amicus briefs and folks regarding national champions and national security trumping antitrust law, all we're asking for in this case is the exact same thing that the Chief Justice instructed the district court to do in Winter v. NRDC. There was an alleged statutory violation of the environmental laws, and the district court entered an injunction that prohibited, in large part, submarine training off the coast of, I believe,
that was
California.
The whales and the warriors.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said that when the district court was deciding whether to enter a permanent injunction, and it needed to tailor its remedy as much as possible to accommodate national security concerns. And that's all we're asking here.
I'm sorry. You haven't offered any market analysis or any sort of financial evidence that would indicate that propounding the district court's injunction would actually harm national security. You've got policy arguments, basically, that it might, right?
Well, Under Secretary Lord and Chief Information Officer Everett, this is for DOD and for DOE, have stated that changing Qualcomm's operations, which is, of course, what the district court's injunction is designed to do, fundamentally alter their practices that have resulted in significant innovation.
Those
and
weren't
also
lodged in the district court, those statements.
Certainly, Your Honor, but Qualcomm raised the national security consideration and the public interest in the district court.
Without market analysis or financial evidence of any national security harm that might occur.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there's a question at this point as to whether Qualcomm waived that issue. The district court certainly.
I'm just trying to, and I think the presiding judge might have been as well, trying to get at what are you offering us here? I mean, I think there's a broad policy concern that foreign governments might access chip technology and have an opportunity to undercut American firms, but there's no evidence of that. I haven't seen any market analysis or anything like that. It's just like, hey, this is something you ought to think about, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. If this court were to remand and the district court were to conduct proceedings in this regard, the government would be prepared to submit additional evidence.
So is your position that the district court's injunction will cause the United States to lose the 5G battle with China and that will impact national security? Is that your position?
Approximately, Your Honor. I think Undersecretary.
Okay, so if Qualcomm profits come at the expense of competition in a violation of the Sherman Act, let's just hypothetically, then aren't we bound to uphold the district court's injunction regardless of any impact on national security? So how do those two interface?
So I think what the Supreme Court's decision in Winter and also in E.I. DuPont teach is that an injunction should be narrowly tailored as much as possible when there are these other public interest considerations. And so one of our concerns here has been the impact of the district court's remedy on the 5G space. The 5G chip market, of course, was not subject to the trial, but the remedy extends into that space. And so it's possible.
You're just asking to weigh in at the remedy stage.
Your Honor. That's what our statement of interest in the district court requested. Was
How
that
could
be
the injunction be more narrowly tailored from your perspective?
Well, I think, first of all, Your Honor, it would be up to the district court to craft that after hearing additional
evidence.
But
what would
evidence.
Your position be? Do you have a position as you stand here today as to how the injunction could be more narrowly tailored? Because that's what you said you want, is for the injunction to be more narrowly tailored. But specifically, if it were remanded, what would your suggestion be to the court as to how it could be more narrowly tailored?
Sure. I can't enumerate all of our suggestions at this point, but one thing that
Can
is
you
apparent.
One?
Yes. One thing that is apparent from Undersecretary Lord's declaration and Chief Information Officer Everett's declaration is that they are very concerned about 5G and innovation in 5G and the standard setting of the 5G process. And so here the remedy extends to the 5G space, even though that was not an issue at trial. So perhaps one area for the district court to explore on remand when considering national security and the public interest is whether the remedy needs to move into the 5G space or whether it should instead be focused on the issues that were at play at the trial, the factual disputes regarding
5G wasn't even talked about in the case, right?
Yes, generally, Your Honor, there are some statements in the district court that touch on 5G, so I don't want to overstate the case. It was an issue, but I don't think the findings were sufficient to indicate that the harm in that the district court found with respect to the markets that were at issue is equally replicable in the 5G space.
All right, counsel, you've exceeded your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Brian Fletcher for the Federal Trade Commission. I'd like to start this morning with the surcharge part of the case because, as my colleague, Mr. Goldstein, said, that really is the heart of the case. And Judge Koh's analysis of that issue is really firmly grounded in a number of very specific factual findings about what Qualcomm has done and how that conduct has harmed competition in the modem chip markets and constitutes anti-competitive conduct under well-settled antitrust standards.
Well, is it illegal for a cellular company to have a licensing division as well as a chip manufacturing
Absolutely
division?
Not.
So that's not illegal. If not, should our antitrust analysis be any different for a company like Qualcomm that is successful in both areas?
No, not in terms, and I want to emphasize the district court's injunction does not interfere with that. It allows Qualcomm to charge whatever prices it wants for its chips, and it allows it to engage in patent negotiations and obtain whatever patent royalties the ordinary patent system would provide.
So is there any evidence in the record that Qualcomm shifts its profits from one division to another in a way that's anti-competitive?
Absolutely, yes. And if I could just modify the framing just a little bit, I think the thing that's anti-competitive is not the shifting of profits as much as it's shifting the cost. And this, I think, really gets to the core of the anti-competitive harm, because my friend Mr. Goldstein said, normally the antitrust laws aren't concerned when a monopolist charges high prices. And he's absolutely right, because normally when a monopolist charges high prices, a competitor can come in, offer a lower price, and enter the market, and customers and competition is better off. The problem with the no license, no chips policy is that Qualcomm has taken part of the price for its chips, the thing that its customers, OEMs, agree to pay to get access to the chips that they need because Qualcomm is a monopolist, and moved it over into what Qualcomm calls its patent royalty. So that's the effect of the no license, no chips policy. It's not just that patent royalties are high in the abstract. It's that OEM after OEM testified that they agreed to pay what they regard as inflated patent royalties, not because they reflect the value of Qualcomm's patents, but only because Qualcomm says to them, if you don't agree to pay these royalties, we won't sell you any chips. That chunk of the patent royalties, that inflation, that's what we call the surcharge. And we call it a surcharge because Judge Koh found, as a matter of fact, that it reflects the value of Qualcomm's monopoly chips, not the value of its patents.
Well, so, but I couldn't find any cases that talked about that that it has to be the intrinsic value. Unless it reflects the patent's intrinsic value, that it would be anti-competitive. So I couldn't find it. Is there a case?
So our concern, this Qualcomm's scheme for sort of shifting part of its price onto its rivals is novel. There's no case that deals with a set of circumstances exactly like this. But I want to emphasize that the problem here isn't that the royalties are above the intrinsic value of the patents. We wouldn't be here if Qualcomm got high patent royalties because it had really good negotiators.
Things are going so fast, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all this.
I apologize.
Okay. All right. If I can refresh myself, the district court found, in terms of surcharging, that the surcharge reflected the monopolistic or illegal value of what, did you say?
Not the it's the monopoly position that Qualcomm has in the
yes.
chip market.
Okay.
So when patent negotiations, ordinarily, the way that they work is the patent holder says, you're infringing my patents, you need to take a license. The
Absolutely.
Other side says, I don't think so. And they reach a determination of an appropriate license rate against the backdrop of ordinary patent law remedies.
All right. Here, I agree that the district court's opinion said that. And I would ask you what specific rationale supported that other than I like that theory better than a different district judge might like it, for instance. I mean, what empirical or market evidence supports her conclusion or the district court's conclusion that that particular behavior constituted the value that you're talking about?
So there's two pieces of it, and I'd separate out a factual one and a legal one, and tell me
okay.
if I'm focused on the wrong one. The factual question is just, are these patent royalties in fact being driven by the chip monopoly and not by the value of the patents?
So what would be wrong with that if it's driven one way or the other? Doesn't the Supreme Court say that patent holders have the right to price their patents. So what would be wrong? What would be anti-competitive about that?
The problem is when Qualcomm says if you want access to our chips, you have to agree to pay these license fees that substantially exceed the amount that would be negotiated absent that threat to chip supply, what it's doing is it's taking part of the monopoly price of its chips and it's moving them over into the patent royalties. And that's anti-competitive. That harms competition.
What case says that it's anti-competitive for Qualcomm to move, even if it's doing that, and to move from the chip to the patent?
Right. So this is.
And while you're at it, to pile on with my colleagues, doesn't Linkline say the opposite when AT&T was doing something very similar?
So first of all, to address Linkline, no, not at all. Linkline is just about setting two prices. The additional conduct here that's missing in Linkline is that requirement, is that saying, if you want my chips, you have to agree to make a payment to me even when you buy from my competitors. And Judge Rawlinson, you asked about another case. I think the most analogous one is Caldera, and that's not just a district court decision.
It is a district court decision outside the circuit.
That's correct. But it's a theory that was reflected in an action brought by the Department of Justice that resulted in a consent decree against the same practice that was approved by the D.C. Circuit. And it reflects a theory, and I think this is really a fundamental point. Actually, even Qualcomm doesn't dispute the fundamental theory that Judge Koh relied on that's reflected in Caldera. Because I don't understand even Qualcomm to say that if they said to OEMs like Samsung and Apple, if you want access to our chips, you have to agree to pay us a fee. We're going to call it a chip access fee.
But
it's on top of
I guess I'm having a hard time seeing how you're not turning it. Every time you say no license, no chips in your brief, it implies that the policy is actually no chips, no license. In other words, buy our chips or we won't give you this SAP license that you need to sell your cell phones. But the actual policy seems to make chip purchases from Qualcomm contingent on SAP license status, not the other way around. So I feel like you're flipping it.
Respectfully, Judge Callahan, I don't think that's right. I think Judge
Koh. And Koh's, I feel like that Judge Koh did too.
Well, Judge Koh was basing her testimony on her finding on testimony from 13 witnesses from 9 different OEMs, 9 different versions of Qualcomm's customers, the people who were sitting at the other side of the table with Qualcomm and who said the reason why we agreed to make these inflated payments to Qualcomm is not because we wanted a patent license. We would have been happy to litigate with Qualcomm about its patents.
Why did the OEMs say it's unfair? Because they have to buy a license? They have to buy a license anyway.
But they don't have to buy a license at the inflated rate that Qualcomm demands. They agree to do that only to get access to Qualcomm's chips. So it's the functional equivalent of Qualcomm doing something that even I don't understand Qualcomm to say it could do, which is to say to OEMs, if you want to buy any of our chips, you're going to have to agree to pay us an extra $10, and you're going to owe us that $10 whether you buy our chips or you buy chips from competitors.
Okay. All right. Here's what I would say to that. Absolutely. Good point. Why don't we let the OEMs exercise their rights in patent law to file predatory pricing, monopoly, abuse of patent claims, whatever, and then the Federal Circuit can deal with it. Who does this stuff all the time?
So precisely, yeah. And I think that was an argument that Qualcomm made at trial, and it pointed out that OEMs in theory have legal rights, mm-hmm. and what OEM after OEM testified is, mm-hmm. we can't do that because mm-hmm. when we try to invoke our ordinary patent law remedies, Qualcomm says, stop it or we'll stop selling you chips. And OEM said, if we can't get Qualcomm's chips, we go out of business. Mm-hmm. So you had very specific testimony from a number of OEM witnesses.
Isn't there evidence, maybe I missed this in passing, that Apple is doing less business with Qualcomm and doing more business with another OEM, Intel or something like this?
And they gave a whole bunch of money back to, like, a bunch of money back to Qualcomm.
So this is getting to the exclusive dealing part of the case, which Judge Koh correctly found that Qualcomm's agreements with Apple constitute exclusive dealing. You're right. Intel eventually was able to break in, but Qualcomm delayed them by 5 years through these exclusive dealing arrangements. And Judge Callahan, you asked about the amount of money that Apple gave back to Qualcomm. And on that point, the reply brief actually significantly misstates the record. So page 53 of the reply brief says that Apple gave up $640 million in incentive payments and clawback penalties to launch with Intel.
I think there's a good argument that, you know, this sort of the, you know, who's the Goliath here? And Apple's more of a Goliath than Qualcomm.
Well, I think in some ways, Apple is the strongest OEM in the market. It's the OEM that was best positioned to launch a viable competitor to Qualcomm. And Qualcomm recognized that, and that's why it went out of its way to enter into these exclusive dealing arrangements to foreclose that mode of entry for competitors. And it succeeded in delaying Intel's entry into the market by 5 years.
It didn't stop Apple. From going to Intel, right?
That's right, but the antitrust laws are concerned with things that substantially impair competition in the markets, not just things that succeed in preventing it entirely. And here the evidence was Apple was all set to work with Intel starting in 2014. Qualcomm recognized that threat, recognized the benefits that would accrue to Intel as a competitor in the market if it got to work with Apple, and then entered into this agreement that sacrificed Qualcomm's profits to buy exclusivity with Apple, and that enforced that exclusivity through these dramatic clawback penalties that were in force until February of 2016. And it was only after those dramatic clawback penalties expired that Apple actually was able to go and work with Intel. That's a substantial competitive harm, Judge Koh found, and we think quite correctly so.
Well, counsel, go ahead. I'm sorry. You go.
If we disagree with you regarding the persuasive nature of Caldera, do you lose?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think you have to rely on Caldera at all, because I think even Qualcomm acknowledges the anti-competitive nature of the conduct that we believe Judge Koh found it has engaged in.
So, what case authority would we rely upon to find a violation? Do you agree that we're only on Section 2 at this point?
I don't, actually.
Oh, you don't? Well, for Section 2 purposes, do you... what case, then, would support your argument if it's not Caldera?
So I think the case that supports our argument, United Shoe Machine, is a Supreme Court case that finds a very similar arrangement of saying you have to pay us even when you deal with our rivals. When a monopolist does that, that's anti-competitive. That's taxing rival sales. That's discouraging customers from turning to competitors. So we think that's another case that addressed similar conduct. If you want to ask, though, and Judge Callahan, Judge Murphy, a couple of you asked about questions about what's the standard here, what's anti-competitive, and how do we determine competitive from anti-competitive behavior. I think Judge Koh got it exactly right at pages 1207 to 1209 of the excerpts of record.
There seems to be some, certainly a reasonable argument that there's a conflation of profitable and anti-competitive.
So there I disagree. I think she gets this court's decision, the definition of anti-competitive conduct from this court's decision in Cascade Health, which is drawn straight from the leading antitrust treatise, it's Hornbook law, is that anti-competitive conduct is conduct that tends to impair the opportunities of rivals without competing on the merits. So if you're harming your competitors because you're offering a better product or a lower price, that's no problem. The antitrust laws aren't concerned with that.
But the Supreme Court has told us not to focus on competitors, but on competition. And there's a difference.
That's absolutely right. Harm to competitors is not sufficient, but the fact that there's harm to competitors doesn't mean that there's no harm to competition. Very often, you harm competition by excluding competitors. The D.C. Circuit's decision in Microsoft is very analogous here, where the court finds that Microsoft engaged in a violation of Section 2 because it engaged in a number of conditions on its customers that made it harder for those customers to work with rival internet browser companies. That's exactly the sort of conduct
here. Well, that's different. Harm to customers is different than harm to competitors.
But here and in Microsoft, you have both. In both cases, a monopolist is saying, we're going to impose contractual conditions on our customers that make it harder for our rivals to gain share. And again, the D.C. Circuit examined those things against the standard that we just talked about and said, these are things that Microsoft is doing that are impairing the opportunities of rivals without competing on the merits.
Is the standard making it more difficult, or... Is that the standard, making it more difficult for competitors? Because that's the nature of business, to make it more difficult for your competitors to operate.
It's two things. It's make it more, tend to impair the opportunities of rivals, is the language from this court's decision in Cascade Health. And then the critical thing that distinguishes it from what's normal in business is without competing on the merits. If you're making it hard for competitors because you have a better product or you sell it for less, no problem. That's not this case. Qualcomm is making it harder for competitors, not because it's offering lower prices or better products. It's making it harder for competitors because it's demanding that its customers pay Qualcomm even when they choose to buy from rivals' products.
If it's not a better product, why wouldn't the manufacturers go to a different product then if the Qualcomm product is not better?
because those manufacturers are still stuck paying Qualcomm's monopoly price, even when they choose to buy from a rival. So I think the testimony of Brian Chong from Wistron, which is an OEM in China, is really instructive. He and Wistron had decided that a better product was offered by one of Qualcomm's competitors, MediaTek, and they were set to go with that, and then they changed their mind once they realized that the agreement that they'd signed with Qualcomm would require them to
agreement.
Pay Qualcomm's license
anyway.
It was
a contractual matter at that point.
It's a contractual matter, but that's often the way that anti-competitive restraints work. So are Microsoft's in the D.C. Circuit case. The problem...
I guess you're saying everything's on the table now, that we're not just dealing with Section 2 and all of that. And so I'm still concerned with the FTC's concession that there it's the duty to deal, that the district court got that wrong and relying on Aspen's scheme, and which was very narrow. And so when I look at the whole, I think the district court was very conscientious, listened to everyone, went through everything as far as that goes. But if you're conceding that was wrong, it seems to pull, the house of cards starts to fall if you pull that out. Your alternative argument, which I think is the contractual violations, doesn't resonate with me the same way.
So let me say two things. One about the sort of the relationship, how the pieces fit together, and then the alternative argument. And on how the pieces fit together, I think as my colleague conceded, the heart of the case really is no license, no chips. That's the thing that Judge Koh found is really impairing competition in this market. That's the finding that supports the first provision of the injunction requiring Qualcomm to stop engaging in the no license, no chips policy. We think that would stand even if you disagreed with our alternative argument about licensing rivals. Now, on the second provision of the injunction that requires Qualcomm to fulfill its commitments to license rivals, we think that that's not properly analyzed as a duty to deal case at all, because it doesn't implicate the principle underlying the duty to deal cases. That principle, as the Supreme Court said in Trinco, is that antitrust law is hesitant to interfere with a business operator's traditional discretion to decide with whom they will deal. But here we're not doing that. Here Qualcomm has already made that decision when it entered into FRAND commitments, and all that we're doing is saying that its refusal to comply with those voluntary commitments ought to be analyzed under traditional antitrust standards. There's no long-recognized right to renege on voluntary contractual commitments. So we just don't think it implicates the same concerns, and we think the Third Circuit's decision—
But didn't Judge Koh find, because they did have a duty to deal, and they're— an ergo antitrust violation?
She did. She found more than she had to there, but she also
found... But you're conceding that was wrong. Not only more than she had to, but that it was wrong.
That's right. We don't think the Aspen standard applies, but Judge Koh didn't just find duty to deal under the Aspen standard. She also separately, and this is at pages ER 1356 to 59, separately analyzes the anti-competitive effect of Qualcomm's refusal to license rivals under traditional Section 2 standards. She talks about how that has prevented rivals from entering, like the Dragonfly joint venture, like MediaTek and Intel. So she separately analyzes the anti-competitive effects of Qualcomm's refusal to license rivals. And if you agree with us on our alternative legal argument that, as the Third Circuit said in Broadcom, when the theory of harm is that a company has breached its FRAND commitments, that's not something that's appropriately analyzed as a duty to deal, then Judge Koh's findings would independently support that provision of the injunction, even without the Aspen skiing bit.
You think Aspen Valley or Aspen, whatever, would be decided, the Aspen scheme, thank you, would be decided the same way today by the present court?
I think you're referring to the court statement in Trinco that it's at or near the outer boundaries of the antitrust laws.
I'm just curious what you think, because you're a very good advocate. But
I agree that Trinco says we're concerned about interfering with this discretion of monopolists to choose with whom they will deal, and for that reason it was skeptical of those claims. I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
Our point is that we don't have that problem because we don't have that compelling someone to deal with an entity with customers that it hasn't chosen to deal with.
That was really a sidelight. Let me ask you something I just can't quite understand intellectually, and maybe you can help me work through it, but I certainly understand no license, no chip. You say what you will, the district court took this case extremely seriously. I mean, the level of work that went into it, the analysis, and we may or may not disagree, I may or may not disagree with the analysis on no license, no chips. But what I can't understand, and you said it a couple of times, is that even if, an OEM is buying from a competitor, they have to pay royalties to Qualcomm. I didn't understand the evidence on that.
So the evidence on that, and I don't think my friends disagree with this, that the license agreements that Qualcomm requires OEMs to sign as part of no license, no chips, cover all of the phones that the OEMs make, no matter whose chips are in them.
All right.
And that's really key. I think one way to think about this case that makes it simple.
The handsets.
The handsets, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So I would think about this case in two steps. I'd first ask, was Judge Koh clearly erroneous to find that Qualcomm's royalties include this sort of surcharge? And we think her finding was definitely not clearly erroneous. It's supported by direct evidence from the people who were sitting on both sides of the table. OEM said, we're only paying this money because we need to get Qualcomm's chips. Qualcomm's own contemporaneous documents say that our chip monopoly position is propping up our licensing revenues. So we think that surcharge finding is reviewed for clear error, and it's not clearly erroneous. Once you accept that, then we think Judge Koh was also correct to say that the scheme that Qualcomm has engaged in is economically and practically equivalent to just saying to OEMs, if you want to buy our chips, you have to agree to pay us a $10 fee every time you buy a rival's chip instead. Sure, it's called a patent license, but it's extracted through the chip monopoly, not through normal patent license negotiation mechanisms. So unless we're going to elevate form over substance, we ought to analyze that surcharge, even though it's called a patent royalty, as the sort of naked surcharge on rivals' chips.
Well, and that's you do say that you repeatedly argue that Qualcomm's royalties include a substantial chip access surcharge that's economically and practically equivalent to a naked tax on rival sales. But if this alleged naked tax applies regardless of whether an OEM buys chips from Qualcomm or a competitor, is it really then a naked tax, or is it an across-the-board tax?
So let me make two points about that. The first is Qualcomm makes a lot out of this argument that our tax is non-discriminatory. We tax our own chips, we tax rivals' chips too. And I do want to explain why even that is extremely anti-competitive. But first, I just want to quibble with the factual premise because it's wrong. The district court found at page 1352 of the excerpts of record that in these negotiations, Qualcomm often enters into what are called chip incentive payments. When an OEM would balk at the royalties that Qualcomm was demanding, Qualcomm would say, we'll make payments and we'll cut you a break on our royalties, we'll reduce your effective royalty rate, but only to the extent that you buy chips from us and not from our competitors. The effect of that is actually to make the surcharge discriminatory. It means the surcharge is bigger, the royalties are more when you buy chips from MediaTek or Intel. And a number of OEM witnesses testified, and one example I'd give you is Grubbs from BlackBerry at excerpts of record 1246 said that because of that chip incentive fund, because the effective royalty rate, the surcharge, was lower when BlackBerry bought from Qualcomm than when it bought from competitors, that, quote, contributed to BlackBerry shifting its modem chip purchases from a competitor to Qualcomm. So actually, even if you agreed with Qualcomm that a non-discriminatory surcharge would be okay, what Qualcomm has imposed in many cases is a discriminatory surcharge, and I haven't heard even Qualcomm defend that.
Counsel, what remains of the Section 1 claim?
So Judge Koh found, and this is page excerpts of record 1381, that Qualcomm had violated both Section 1 and Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And she made that finding because she concluded, and I think both sides agreed at trial, that the analysis under both of them is the same. Once you agree that Qualcomm has monopoly power, and it's conceded that it does, the question that we're asking is it engaged in anti-competitive conduct? And if so, is that outweighed by any pro-competitive justifications that
but
Qualcomm
might
offer?
Those are two separate statutes. I mean, two separate provisions. So is your argument that if there is a violation of Section 2, there's automatically a violation of Section 1? Is that what you're arguing?
Not in every case, but I think...
But is that your argument?
Sorry, not as to every alleged violation in this case, as to most of them.
I'm asking you what remains of the Section 1 claim. What specific findings do you say also apply to the Section 1 claim?
The surcharge holding, we think, applies fully equally to Section 1 and Section 2 both. The place where it would be different is the duty-to-deal theory. Our duty-to-deal theory, because that involves unilateral conduct and not agreements the way that the surcharge does, that's primarily relying on Section 2. The duty-to-deal claim, we think, would make out a claim under either Section 1 or Section 2. Judge Koh, we think, correctly said that courts have been willing to recognize that exclusive dealing constitutes a violation of the antitrust laws under Section 2 a little bit more readily under Section 1. So her finding there took account of the difference between the two, although we think it would support a violation under either statute.
Under both of them?
That's correct.
About 6 or 7 minutes ago, you spoke about an argument you made on taxing of rival sales, that, and you cited a case, and I didn't catch the case, I'm sorry to say.
So an earlier one, this is United Shoe Machine, which is from the Supreme Court, and it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You want to take a license to our shoemaking machines, you're going to have to agree to pay us a royalty, even when you're using somebody else's machines instead. And I think that just gets to the idea that when you require your customers to pay you, even when they choose to buy from someone else, that interrupts the ordinary competitive functioning of the market. It mm-hmm. means that rivals can't come in and undercut your price because your customers are stuck paying your price even when they go to the rivals instead. I think that really gets at the second part of my answer to Judge Callahan, mm-hmm. which is, what if this is a non-discriminatory surcharge? Why is that anti-competitive? And the district court's findings explain why, and our expert explained why as well. It's that you have to imagine what would happen if Qualcomm couldn't impose this surcharge on its rival's sales. Would it keep the surcharge on its own sales? And if it did that, then Qualcomm would be losing sales to its rivals, who would turn.
I don't know. Your argument that Qualcomm's licensing fees raise rivals' costs doesn't make sense to me, because the chip supplier's costs with respect to manufacturing and distributing modems have nothing to do with the licensing royalty that is paid by OEMs independently of their purchase of the modems.
So the reason it raises rivals' costs is that it effectively acts just like a tax on the transaction. It's, if you're going to buy a chip from a rival chip maker like MediaTek or Intel, the customer is going to have to pay not just the price that's owed to MediaTek or Intel, but also a substantial surcharge to Qualcomm, to a third party. So it works just like a tax. And what the testimony from our expert at trial was, and what Judge Koh's finding was, is that that's split between the two parties. The way it's split depends a little bit on the elasticities of supply and demand, but each of them ends up feeling some of the pain. Each of them ends up making a contribution to the money that ends up in Qualcomm's pocket instead of in theirs.
Well,
that's the way it raises
rivals'
costs.
Maybe being overly capitalistic, but not necessarily anti-competitive?
Well, I don't think so. And I think this is really the key. This is something that's missing from Qualcomm's brief and from Mr. Goldstein's presentation. They have not explained how it is that this practice is competition on the merits. That's capitalism, is lower prices, better products. But that's not the explanation for Qualcomm's practices. And the easiest way to see that is the point that you raised earlier about how this is unique to Qualcomm and the industry. OEM after OEM said, no one else does this to us.
But unique, isn't it? But that, I guess, on the other... But on the other side, people that are unique a lot of times get the edge, and that's what fosters competition and disruptors and that type of thing. And so I feel like if we conflate being unique in the industry as the equivalent of anti-competitive, that can't be right.
It's certainly not sufficient, but I think it should be a red flag. And I think it's even more a red flag because it's not just unique within the industry, it's unique within Qualcomm. The evidence was, and Judge Koh found, that Qualcomm itself doesn't impose this no license, no chip policy in markets where it doesn't have monopoly power. So no one else in the industry does this no license, no chips
but
business.
But is being unique illegal?
No. But being unique, imposing a policy that a district court has found to be anti-competitive, that no one else does, that you do only in the markets where you have a monopoly and you don't do in markets where you don't have a monopoly, I think is a red flag that it's not actually efficient, that it's instead a way of exploiting and entrenching your monopoly power. Hmm. And I think, you know, that again, that's not enough to condemn it. I think it ought to be a red flag for the court. I think it reinforces Judge Koh's factual findings and analysis. And I think it also ought to give the court some comfort that Judge Koh's injunction prohibiting Qualcomm from continuing to engage in this practice is not going to harm efficiency, is not going to upset the markets, because it's enjoining a practice that has been unique to this company, that has perpetuated its monopoly position.
Well,
it might invite highly deleterious foreign interests to come into our markets, though. Agree?
I don't.
Why not?
So I don't agree with that because for a couple of reasons. First of all, I don't think, as Your Honor's questions to my colleague from the Department of Justice pointed out, I think the national security type concerns that the Department of Justice has raised for the first time on this appeal are extremely abstract. They suggest that things that diminish Qualcomm's profits could diminish national security, but they don't make any specific arguments about the ways that this injunction diminishes national security. And I guess even more fundamentally, I'd say the policy of the antitrust laws is that the national interest is best served by vigorous competition. And I think it's a little bit ironic for Qualcomm to be saying, we deserve special solicitude because we're important to national security, because we're the only American supplier of 5G technology, when one of the reasons why it's the only American supplier of 5G technology is that Judge Koh found that it has squelched its American competitors, like Intel and like Broadcom, which at the time was an American company. I think the antitrust laws reflect a policy that the national interest, competition, and innovation are served through vigorous competition.
Isn't that belied by since the fact that this has been stayed, and now there's a lot more people in the market, and Qualcomm is losing? The numbers are going down?
Judge Callahan, I don't think that's quite right. So Qualcomm points out that it was losing share leading up to the close of discovery in 2018. It still had a huge share in the 4G LTE market, over 64% projected by Qualcomm's own documents. And Judge Koh made a specific finding based on a lot of evidence at trial about what the 5G environment was likely to look like, that Qualcomm was likely to continue to have a monopoly position once the market transitioned to 5G. That's a factual finding based on evidence at trial, including Qualcomm's own documents. And she further found that those market share figures are a little bit misleading. So it's true that Qualcomm had lost some share, but its competitors were in a very precarious position. MediaTek, one of them, had exited the premium LTE market altogether and wasn't competing in that high-end section of the market. Intel executives testified that their chip business had never been profitable, that they were in a very precarious position. And some of the share losses were to Huawei and Samsung, which were manufacturing their own chips in-house. They'd been forced to do that by Qualcomm's conduct. But Huawei and Samsung didn't sell chips to other OEMs. They couldn't compete with Qualcomm for that business, in part because Qualcomm had refused to license them, executives from both companies said. So while it's true that some of Samsung and Huawei's share at the time that discovery had closed had shifted from Qualcomm internally to those companies, that doesn't fully reflect the competitive environment. Judge Koh was still very correct to find that Qualcomm's conduct had hobbled its competitors and that Qualcomm was likely to persist in its domination of the markets as it transitioned to 5G.
Well, counsel, I take it, that you would not be amenable to a remand for the court to consider national security interests as posited by the Department of Justice.
We'd urge you not to do that, Your Honors. Obviously, that's up to the court, but I think there are two reasons to be cautious about doing that here. The first is that you'd have to find that Judge Koh abused her discretion by failing to consider issues that Qualcomm abandoned. It raised national security in a pretrial filing, but then never put on any evidence of it at trial. DOJ filed a statement of interest in the district court 3 months after the trial ended, asking for proceedings on remedy, but importantly, didn't say a word to Judge Koh about the national security interest that it's now pressing before you. So I think you should be very hesitant to find an abuse of discretion based on something that wasn't before Judge Koh at all. And I don't think, for some of the reasons that Judge Murphy's questions identified, that the submission that DOJ has put before you now is sufficiently specific or gives you sufficient grounds to require a remand for those purposes.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We've helped you exceed your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think the parties agree that everyone would benefit if the court doesn't stop with the duty to deal question and does address the fundamental issue of whether there's a harm to the competitive process here, because it's very important to the industry, and we may well be back with you in any event. The court could stop there, but we do think the issue is squarely presented and ought to be decided. On the surcharging question, I do think I'm in the very fortunate position that I can say to you, assume all of the things that my friend says about the nature of our customer relationships and prices and all of those things. We obviously disagree. But then what? So where he gets to the point is he says, look, we use our monopoly power to get higher patent royalties, and that causes our rivals to make less money. If that's correct, we win this case, because that is what happens in business all the time, and the question is whether there's a harm to the competitive process. And there is a body of law about that. Now, he points to one body.
Well, but he says it delays or interferes with the ability of the competitors to enter the market. Not that they make less money, but it interferes with their ability. So,
but it does that because they make less money. Remember, Judge Koh thought, her theory was this. We cause our competitors to make less money. Therefore, they engage in less research and development. And therefore, they make fewer competitive products, and therefore, their ability to enter the market is interfered with. That is just the idea that raising rivals' costs is always anti-competitive, and that is not the law. The two bodies of cases are the Caldera, U.S. Shoe kind of cases. And that's where you have a naked tax, where you say to someone, even though you're not using my product, you're going to pay for it. And the reason that that is sometimes thought to be anti-competitive, depending on the circumstances, is that it causes the customer to choose you rather than the other party. That is admittedly, by the FTC, not the structure here. That is not what is happening.
Well, they're saying, in essence, that's the same thing you're doing. You're calling it something else.
That's right.
But so, when the cover is pulled off, it really is just a naked tax.
That's exactly. I understand that that's their argument. But just recognize that not even Judge Koh thought that the structure was the same. Because it is absolutely clear that the OEM that takes our patent license, we have the right to license the patent because our technology, which is throughout the handset, when you are that cell phone maker and you have our license, then you have to pick which chip you're going to use. And our license doesn't cause you to pick our chip versus somebody else's. That's totally different from the Caldera situation.
What do you do with the testimony that was referenced by opposing counsel from the manufacturers?
Right. They have one guy. There is a single witness who, in a single sentence about one phone in a non-monopolized market, said he thought that he would not choose a competitor's product over Qualcomm's product because he would have to somehow pay back the license fees. That is simply just not right, and there was no basis to extrapolate, despite the fact that no other OEM was willing to say that, because the license agreements just don't work that way. Because it doesn't affect your choice, there's no basis to extrapolate to the idea that it causes a choice of one or the other. But in any event, just assume that's true, okay? Even assume that it somehow, in a way we don't understand and can't be explained, affects the choice between chips. Then what? The question is always, then what? Is the price such, or is the effect on competition such, that we have interfered with the competitive process? And there's just no evidence of that. To just draw an analogy, Your Honor, you said, look to the government. There's no evidence about, you know, markets, what's happening mm-hmm. with respect to 5G and that sort of thing. There's no evidence on the underlying theory of liability, right? There's no argument whatsoever that we engage in below-cost pricing at all. Judge Koh found the opposite, that we engage in monopolistic pricing. Now, just and without
Mr.
taking
it, Mr. Fletcher asked why Qualcomm hasn't offered any evidence of why its pricing theories and actions on the chips are helpful to the American consumer.
And that is to say, what's the pro-competitive justification?
Right.
The pro-competitive justification here is absolutely obvious, and that is the law encourages us to license our patents, to spread technology, to charge as high patent rates as we can in order to have an incentive to innovate. The law encourages us to offer our customers discounts. That's why it's so dangerous to do what the FTC would like you to do, which is to relabel things that are perfectly legal, patent royalties and chip discounts, and turn them into something that's illegal. Because if you adopt a legal rule that invites second-guessing of all those things and equates them with a naked tax on, you know, the purchase of a rival's product, the amount of litigation, the amount of doubt that comes in about whether you're going to have high patent royalties or low discounts is enormous. That's why we have rules.
Anti-competitive behavior is illegal under the Sherman Act. Hyper-competitive behavior is not.
Is encouraged.
This case asks us to draw the line between the two, correct?
Well, the FTC asks you, with respect, to elide the line and turn things that the law encourages, relabel them and deem them illegal. No case, I will just say this, and I just believe it's unquestionably right. There is no case in the history of antitrust law that does something like that, that just recharacterizes something that is encouraged by the law as if it were something illegal, as a tax. If you wanted to know what the closest case is, it is clearly the Supreme Court's decision in Linkline, which this court in the Abbott Labs case says applies even if the precise structure of the squeeze is different. And that is exactly what happened there is what is alleged to have happened here, and that is the monopolist is alleged to have lowered the retail price, which they say we do through discounting, and raised the wholesale price, which they say we do through the high patent royalties, and squeezed the rivals so that they couldn't compete and shift money between the two. And the Supreme Court said, you cannot take two bad theories, just relabel what's going on and have an antitrust violation. There has to be predatory pricing or a duty to deal. If you don't have those things, you don't have a case.
I know I apologize. I know you're over time. I do apologize to everyone.
I have one question.
Everyone,
I have questions. So we have permission.
The marathon continues.
Yeah. So my recollection, even though it was written in, I think, 1922, of United Shoe, is that the Supreme Court found monopolistic, anti-competitive behavior when the shoe company was charging competitors rents on machines, and the competitors had to pay, shoemaking machines, and the competitors had to pay rents to United Shoe, even if they found the ability to manufacture the shoes elsewhere. Mr. Fletcher seemed to indicate, and I wrote down what I thought was a pretty interesting point about taxing rivals' behavior. What distinguishes even that we're talking technologically different?
U.S. Shoe and Caldera are pretty similar, and that is monopolist says to customer, if you use my competitor's product and don't use mine, you're paying me anyway. That is not what happens here. We say to our customers, you will take a patent royalty because everyone agrees that we are entitled to do that. Now, if you use the customer, you use our competitor's chip, we are not going to charge you more. You can pick based on the merits of the chip. And it requires all kinds of gymnastics to recharacterize a discount that we offer to the customer that the law encourages and turn that into something that is very, very different. Remember, the reason the law is hostile to that is that there is no pro-competitive justification. What business do I have saying to an OEM, even though you're not using my product, I've got no basis to charge you for using the competitor's product. Right. I'm going to do it anyway just because I can. Right. Okay, we get the law is hostile to that. But the law is encouraging us to license our patents. It is.
Right. Judge Callahan, okay. I have a question.
This was on the summary judgment. Mm. All right, so you're here. You're asking for the injunction to be reversed.
Yes.
All right. But on the summary judgment, you're saying there are triable issues? Because even if we were in first, hypothetically, if we were to reverse the injunction, if we affirm the summary judgment, then that part would be over. But you're saying there are triable issues to go back on that?
To give you the context, they concede the duty to deal ruling by the district court is wrong. They say we have another way to get to the same place. It runs through the summary judgment. The summary judgment, they say, establishes we're wrong on the contract. Then they say the contract violation is an antitrust violation. So if you were to accept the summary judgment ruling and not find that there were triable issues of material fact, then you would reach their alternative ground for affirmance on duty to deal. If you were to agree with us that there are triable issues of material fact, then, and the case were to continue, we think the case should end, but if the case were to continue, then the judge would decide who was, have a trial on who was right under the contract.
Counsel, do you take issue with opposing counsel's representation that Qualcomm only imposes the surcharge in markets where there is a monopoly and not where there is a lack of a monopoly?
Yes. Yeah, so if you go to page 173, I think it is, of the district court's ruling, the district court makes absolutely clear that we get the same license rate across the board. At the time of trial, it was 5%. So there are two monopolized markets, CDMA and premium LTE. We get that rate in non-premium LTE, WCDMA. I can give you a bunch of letters. But the same rate applies whether it's monopolized or not monopolized. If I could just help explain what he meant, he was trying to say.
Well, no, I think he spoke for himself.
Okay. I don't mean to.
And my final question is, you thought that only Section 2 is at issue here, and opposing counsel says that there are claims that still remain under Section 1.
And what happened? We're both saying essentially the same thing, and that is to the extent the district court thought Section 1 was involved, it all runs through the same Section 2 theory.
All right. Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments in this challenging case. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court, and we will return to the case of Weber versus TMG Logistics. Thank you.